This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. I'm John Soper. Coming up, we'll visit the dirty power plant that provides a lot of Newfoundland's electricity during the winter months. A construction company's efforts to recruit women into the heavy equipment workforce is paying dividends. A journalist from St. John's returns from a stint teaching the craft to students in Rwanda. And we'll visit the bird boy of Gander. But first, just a few years ago, CBC Radio introduced you to a young man named Ramsey Say. When he and his family arrived in St. John's in 2000, they were penniless and in search of a better life. They had come from Kosovo, where they were witnesses to the most horrendous crimes of war. Now, 7 years later, Ramsey Say is well on his way to that better life that he dreamed of. He's this year's Rhodes Scholarship winner for Newfoundland and Labrador. He spoke with Jeff Gilhooly of the St. John's Morning Show.
What's a scholarship like this mean to you?
It means a lot of things, I guess. It in the end means that I can finally do something that I've dreamt of doing for such a long time. Something that I guess came from that experience of being a refugee and from experiencing war. And it's just incredible. I'm still getting over the fact that I'm one of the lucky ones.
You must be. Well, you're well earned, and we're going to get into some of that in a second. I'm just thinking to myself here, how many Rhodes Scholarship candidates speak seven languages? You're up to seven now?
Yes, I speak seven at variable sort of in variable levels, but with changing borders and changing cultures in the Balkans, I would say eight now.
So there's dialects so thrown into, probably, yeah.
Serbian, okay. And Serbo-Croatian seem to have sort of become two different languages.
Yeah. Let me just tell our listeners something about you here. You've got a 3.8 grade point average at Memorial University. For those who don't know, you can only go to four. Four is the highest. Since you've been in our province, you've served as an interpreter for other refugees. You've worked with Amnesty International, the AIDS Committee. You're the youngest recipient of the YMYWCA Peace Medal. You've won the Terry Fox Humanitarian Award. The list goes on and on. Did you ever think to yourself that you'd ever do any of that when you came to St. John's?
I guess the first thought is no. When my family and I first settled here, I think the biggest priority was just adjusting to St. John's and adjusting to Canada and the many differences, cultural differences that there are. As time went by, I kind of, I guess, realized and thought about it that there were some things that I wanted to get through to people, questions that they were asking me, things about the conflict. And I guess from that grew a passion that had begun at an early age. I come from a family that's so devoted to social justice. My sister works at a humanitarian aid agency, and my parents were always encouraging us to get involved with the movement. So
the news release that accompanied the announcement talks about how, as a child, you and your classmates watched in terror as your teacher put wet clothes to the window of your school in Kosovo to keep the nerve gas from being sprayed on you or getting inside the classroom. There was a peace protest outside and they had been sprayed. How does something like that affect a child?
Well, at an early age, I guess it really does affect you. The fact that I remember it now, 17 years later, is, I guess, evidence of how much it's affected me. When you're growing up and you don't really know what ethnic conflict means and you don't know what ethnic divisions are, the only thing that speaks to you is the I guess, that fearful face of your teacher who's trying to do what her utmost to protect you.
Protect you somehow, yeah.
And that's perhaps one of the most startling things that ever happened to me that I can, I guess, remember so well in clear detail.
Mm. On top of everything else, we all remember a couple of years ago, we watched at the airport as you worried. Your family was seeking and eventually found your brother who had been lost in the war. We all remember the reunion that happened. After everything you've been through, now you're going to go away. You're after this, you're heading over to the UK. How difficult is that going to be?
Well, for my mother, I think it will be difficult because, and I guess for everyone in my close friend circle, but specifically for her, because we haven't really had a time. We've never kind of been away from one another for a long time. And I think the war kind of really brought us together, and we were so close to each other, and having me for the first time in for I guess a long term sort of schooling education, that's one of the difficulties I'll have to get through, and we'll have to kind of face that as it comes. But she's just delighted that
I
have this opportunity.
Very proud of you, no doubt. Yeah, it's a tremendous opportunity. What are you going to study in Oxford?
I hope to study get a BA in law with a specific emphasis on international humanitarian law, that is vulnerable populations in armed conflicts.
Okay. When you become Secretary General of the United Nations, will you still do interviews with us?
I look forward to that time.
We do too. Congratulations again.
Thanks, Jeff,
for coming in.
Ramsey Say is the Newfoundland and Labrador winner of the 2007 Rhodes Scholarship. Another construction season is winding down in Western Labrador. It's been a busy one as mining companies expand to meet the high demand for iron ore. That's meant more work for contractors like H.J. O'Connell. But the construction company has had a hard time finding skilled workers. H.J. O'Connell has turned to a non-traditional workforce to meet that demand. Mike Power has that story.
Krista Butler walks towards the truck she's driving today. The Mack Tandem is 10 meters long. It's idling smoothly, almost purring like a giant cat. Krista grew up in Cox's Cove on the province's west coast, and several years ago noticed more and more women were being employed in non-traditional trades like heavy equipment operators. So she took a heavy equipment operator's course, but finding work where she lived wasn't so easy. So she headed north.
When I came here, it wasn't hard to find stuff in, something in Labrador, but out around home, it wasn't really easy to, because they wanted people with experience, but O'Connell seemed to give everyone a chance, so.
Krista was hired by H.J. O'Connell Construction. With a shortage of skilled workers, O'Connell turned towards hiring more female workers to fill its roster. This season, about 20% of their 140 workers were female. And remember Krista's lack of experience? Tom Day is O'Connell's safety coordinator. He says the company has found a way to give people with the basics the skills they need to safely operate different kinds of equipment.
We've hired a full-time trainer, and this year we've certainly seen the benefits of that. We see the problem in the marketplace right now in getting skilled labor, and it's important that we do have trained people on this equipment.
This is the tailgate locks here. So sometimes where it's cold and the material is frozen in the box, sometimes they don't lock. Pretty good.
It's one last safety check before Krista signals for a loader to fill the big truck. As she explains the process, she can't help but use a little truck driver play on words.
I'm getting loaded right now.
Getting loaded here means filling the truck for today's job.
Usually haul between 17 to 20 ton. We're going out to IOC now. They're doing a job out there, TS5, and we're going to be hauling Class A out there for them.
She says this is a good opportunity.
Usually 7 o'clock we start, 10 hours a day. Roughly make about seven, eight loads a day. Well, it's a lot better than having to work for $7 or $8 an hour.
Krista says it's encouraging to see more women enter what once was considered work done only by men.
There wasn't a lot working on the tandems. There was a lot of the girls out on the 777s and stuff like that in the mine. There was mostly all women on those, but it was just me and another lady driving the tandems. Well, I guess they're just realizing now that they can pretty much do whatever a man can do, so I would encourage someone to take a trade rather than do something like traditional, or seems like it's a lot better.
Meanwhile, Tom Day says the numbers are growing. He hopes to encourage more people who usually don't work in the construction business to come on board.
I'm not sure if other companies are seeing it, but I know people are seeing it, and certainly associations. For example, we have a very close working relationship with the LIA or the Nunatsiavut government. In fact, we had a delegation here just last month that came in to look at our operation and talk with some of the people that have gone through the training program with us. It's been a tremendous success this year. Krista is a perfect example. We have many more like her, particularly an Inuit lady who was with us for most of the summer. And she developed into quite a good both truck driver and front-end loader operator.
Day says his company will lobby government to make more trades and construction-related courses available at the local college. He thinks more women would work in the industry if they didn't have to leave Labrador West to attend school. That's exactly what Krista Butler is thinking about when her seasonal job ends soon. She knows the more skills she has, the more work she'll get.
I've looked at doing some training maybe for the mobile crane course. I think I'll probably go back and do that sometime. Not quite sure when yet. Well, it should be a lot easier to get a job then, because not only will I have heavy equipment, but I'll also have crane too, which is a good course.
And chances are she'll have no problem finding work again with O'Connell Construction. Tom Day says a large number of women who worked for them this construction season prevented them from having a serious shortage of workers, so they plan to keep encouraging more people who wouldn't normally work for them to take a look at the opportunities the way Krista Butler did. Meanwhile, Krista Butler turns her truck around and gets ready to make another trip into the mines, hoping that where she leads, other women will follow. In Labrador West, I'm Mike Power.
I'm John Soper, and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. Most people in the province probably think of electricity as a clean energy source, but a big chunk of electricity on the island is generated by burning oil, more than 1 million barrels a year, to be precise. Here's Zach Gowdy's look at the Holyrood Generating Station.
8 a.m., and two orange-suited technicians are climbing one of the three 300-foot-tall smokestacks at the Holyrood Power Station. The view from up there must be incredible. The small, picturesque town of Holyrood on one side, Conception Bay on the other, and acres of forest in every direction. In this pristine landscape, the hulking power plant with its candy cane-striped smokestacks seems oddly out of place. But its place in our lives is very real. Don Daly is the manager of communications with Newfoundland Hydro.
We happen to be here. We're here in the morning, first of all. So I can tell you right now, that plant is firing up to meet what our consumers and you and I, electricity users, are using this morning. So when we get up and we flip on our lights and our alarm clock goes off, our system, hydro system, starts revving up as well to meet those energy needs.
To meet those needs, Newfoundland Hydro has 10 power stations throughout the province. The other 9 are hydro plants. This one is a thermal plant, meaning it burns fuel to get the energy it needs to make electricity. Last year, they burned 1.3 million barrels of oil here in Holyrood at a cost of $63 million. Daly says it's not a pretty statistic, but in Newfoundland, there's no other way to generate power.
There's no big hydropower projects left that are environmentally appropriate on the island that we can pull in to help this. We can offset it with wind. We can offset it by burning a cleaner fuel. And we can do it by energy conservation or a link from Labrador. But this plant is, again, absolutely critical right now to keeping people warm and homes heated.
The Holyrood plant is one of the oldest, least efficient, most expensive plants in Hydro's system. Burning oil to generate electricity emits sulfur, nitrous oxide, carbon dioxide, and a host of other nasty pollutants. A link from Labrador would mean this plant could be shut down for good. But Daly says, in the meantime, we wouldn't get by without it.
You, me, all electricity consumers are using far more power now than we've ever used. Sometimes this plant doesn't run in the summer. It's absolutely still, quiet, nothing happening because we don't need that power. But in the winter, when we're all sitting at home and our heaters are up on 2022, that plant is running.
In plant manager Terry LeDrew's office, he, Dally, and I suit up in orange vests, steel-toed boots, and earplugs. Then LeDrew leads the way onto the production floor.
Okay, got your earplugs in? So right here now we're standing in front of the steam turbine, and this is the actual component that takes the steam energy that's generated in the boiler and converts it to rotational energy for the generator to generate electricity. As you can sense, you can feel the energy coming from the component, the noise, the vibration, and actually feel the radiant heat coming off the component.
This machinery is designed with no aesthetic considerations, 100% function over form. Giant boilers and turbines, thick steel connected by a web of hoses and wire. There are three furnaces for burning oil, one for each smokestack. Burning oil and transmitting the electricity over long distances to consumers isn't a very efficient process. A modern thermal plant converts only 60% of the energy from the fuel it burns into electricity. This one was built in the 1960s, and LeDrew says it's much worse.
Overall thermal efficiency, not proud of it, but this plant will operate around 37-38% on average throughout the year. So a dollar worth of oil is generating you 37 cents worth of electricity.
In the control room, a team of operators work to keep the amount of electricity the plant is generating closely matched with the demand at the particular moment.
We have a very typical daily sequence on weekdays and then something different on weekends. So our cyclic is caused by the patterns of people that live in our communities, when they typically get up, when they typically are drawing energy in their homes for cooking, washing. You have a morning peak that comes on for about an hour and a half, and then we'll have a lunch peak and we'll have a supper peak. And those peaks, as I say, if it gets colder throughout the day, that peak will be higher than what it was the day before.
The people who live and work near the Holyrood station are reminded every day where their electricity comes from when they see those three smokestacks piping black clouds into the sky. They've called for scrubbers to be built at the plant and stricter controls to cut the emissions of sulfur and other chemicals. But Hydro would rather build a transmission line carrying Lower Churchill power between Labrador and Newfoundland so they could shut the Holyrood plant down completely. If the transmission line doesn't go ahead and the Holyrood plant stays open, Don Daly says Hydro will install the scrubbers and make other improvements. Until then, LeDrew says Hydro is doing what they can to minimize the environmental impact of the plant, but he says people can do something about it for themselves.
Any consumption of a fossil fuel has with it side effects, which I guess we all somewhat take for granted when we flick that switch on. And we ourselves here at the plant, our role is to consume the least amount of fuel to generate the same amount of electricity as we can. The conservation side is at the customer doorstep to look at how they consume the energy day in and day out, and whether there's ways and means that they can do things a little bit more efficiently themselves. Right?
So think about the Holyrood plant and those 1.3 million barrels of oil every time you leave a light on in an empty room. I'm Zach Gowdy.
Rwanda is not a place that most people want to go to. In the 1990s, the Hutu government sought to crush the Tutsi minority, and close to a million people were killed in just a few months. A couple of months ago, reporter Lee Pitts went to Rwanda to teach journalism in a program sponsored by Ottawa's Carleton University and the National University of Rwanda. Back in St. John's now, he spoke with Jeff Gilhooley.
Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Jeff.
How was it?
It was fantastic. It was a great experience. I'm so glad I went, because I was on the fence for a couple of days there when they first offered it to me. Yeah, it was worth it.
Well, you look no worse to wear, but now you got to tell us a little bit more what you were doing there. I mentioned school of journalism, I guess.
That's right. I was working with the School of Journalism and Communications, and I was teaching a TV journalism course to the second year class of the journalism students there, 30 students in all. Yeah. And it was one of those classes that I thought I was going in to teach just journalism, and I got there and realized some of them had never seen a television camera before. So I really had to start from scratch with the basics, rip up the lesson plan, and, you know, fly by the seat of my pants when they got there.
Were most of them keen, though?
They were. Yeah. They were so keen. And I love the way they asked questions, because they always asked a question that led the class this way or that way, and they ended up learning a bit more. And because English is their third language, one student would always say, "You will tell me how the camera works," or "I want to know, and you will tell me." It was just fantastic, and they led. You know, they often led the classes that way.
Makes teaching fun, I bet.
It did. Yeah. It really did. I hated the marking and the grading part of it all.
Listen, you get to, like, now, geographically, where were you?
I was in the southern part of the country. Okay. It's 126 kilometers from the capital, but it's about 2.5 hours by bus. Yeah. And it was in the southern part. I was about 50 kilometers away from Burundi.
Okay.
So it's the second biggest city there. They say roughly 90,000 people, but it's one of those places where one town turns into the other and turns into the other. Every bit of land is used there.
Yeah. Oh, I bet you saw things you'd never see before, right?
Yeah. Well, the first memory I have of getting there is the smell, because there was just, you know, the smell of, I guess, a little bit of garbage mixed in there, a lot of sweat, a lot of body odor, and it didn't take long before I was adjusted to it and probably contributing to it, you know?
Yeah.
But when I first got there, like, those smells were just so ripe and raw, and I thought, where am I? But, it quickly went away, or I got used to it or something.
Politically, what's the situation now between the Tutsis and the Hutu?
I think it may always be a little bit tense or unclear. On the surface, and from what I could tell, they're all one people. You know, these two ethnic groups of Hutu and Tutsis don't exist anymore. The identity cards that actually label them as Hutu or Tutsi, they're gone, and they all work together sort of as one group. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they're being led by essentially the same person who liberated the country, Paul Kagame, who is a Tutsi. And so they kind of have a Tutsi government there. So on the surface, it seems like everything is okay. Some people have told me, you know, we wonder what will happen if the government changes hands. And there's always a bit of a fear that some of the fighting will come back. In neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, there are rebel groups of the Tutsis and Hutus that are fighting. And there's always fear that there could be some spillover back into Rwanda. And one person told me, he said, it's kind of a scary thought when you think about it. He said, we're always afraid the government's going to change and that this could happen. The genocide could happen again. Mm-hmm. But at least this time, he says, I'd hope they'd use guns. So even though people would die, it would happen instantly instead of the suffering.
Take us into the life, I guess, of the average person there. I mean, I appreciate you weren't there all that long, but you must have a sense of how they live.
Yeah, I mean, granted, I was working for the university and they put me in a nice house and I had running water and I had luxuries that some people didn't have. But I think, you know, that was rare. I mean, there is a middle class there, and we often forget that. There are your lawyers, your teachers who have nice houses, nice cars, eat at nice restaurants. But the majority of the people there are living in poverty. They live on a dollar a day or less. Sometimes they just live on whatever crops they grow on their fields. They'll grow bananas and potatoes, and that may be their supper. As a result, you know, many of them are vegetarians. Meat is a luxury. They live in homes they built themselves from mud. So they you know, dig up the mud, mix it with water and twigs, create bricks, and these adobe-style homes are what they live in. And this is basically, they go to the market, they haggle, they may trade things, but this is basically their lifestyle. It's subsistence farming. The idea of going to school or having anything beyond that is, for many of them, out of the realm of possibilities. Yeah.
We were told that our Thanksgiving, you had bananas.
Yes. Well, I had a chicken as well.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
What was your diet like when you were there then? Can you give us an idea of what a daily intake of food would consist of?
And maybe for me, where I worked for the university, it was a bit different. Yeah. We had a chef. So I was tasting fantastic food that was, you know, prepared really well. But it was still local cuisine. A lot of bananas.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you can do with these not sweet bananas, but the other kind. Mashed bananas, boiled bananas, fried bananas, banana french fries. We had potatoes, avocados that grew in our backyard. They were just fresh.
Ooh.
They were picked, peeled, and on your plate. Our chef was vegetarian as well, so he made some, you know, using local produce, eggplants, whatever he could find. He'd make ratatouille and other kinds of pasta dishes. But, you'd see a lot of that. Anything you have was fresh. If they have chicken, the chicken was prepared that morning, you know. You could hear it in the backyard in the morning. By lunchtime, it wasn't there anymore.
Okay.
A lot of goat meat as well. And it's the same thing. Yeah. It was fresh. You'd see goats walking into the back of the restaurant. And you had supper.
Tremendous experience, professionally and otherwise, no doubt. Would you like to go back sometime?
I would, actually. I'd really like to go back. I'd like to go back and teach another class, ideally with the same students, so I can build on what I've started, but even with the next crew coming through, because I got to meet all the students at the School of Journalism, and I thought, you know, I'd love to work with them as well. They now know me. There's a relationship there. I know what they know, what they don't. I know what I did, what I would do differently. So I'd love to go back if I could. I'd also love to go elsewhere there if I, you know, with throughout Africa as
see
well
a bit
because
more
there's,
of a, yeah.
there's so much to see.
No doubt there is. Well, I'm glad you had a good time and you're back safe and sound.
Oh,
good to talk to you.
Lee Pitts is a journalist based, for now at least, in St. John's. He was speaking with Jeff Gilhooly. I'm John Soper and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. A 10-year-old boy in Gander has what many people might consider to be an unusual hobby. He's raising chickens. Reporter David Seltzer dropped over to the chicken coop with Jared Matthews to get the scoop.
In an old barn behind a friend's house, Jared Matthews tends four chickens in a coop he built last summer with his dad.
This one's named Missy. This is a bantam. This is a bantam down here, Melody. And this brown one over here is a comet. That's the one that lays the green eggs. And that's Pansy. That's a golden comet.
Twice a day, every day, Jared checks for eggs and makes sure there's plenty of water and feed.
Well, chickens, I just like chickens because they're not really like a normal bird. They're not as fragile as a normal bird would be. And you can just get eggs from them, come up here, clean the cage out, and just spend time with them. It's really funny, too, how they whack and move their head and stuff.
Jared's mother, Shauna, says her son has had a major interest in birds of any feather for 4 years.
He's built all kinds of bird houses. He built one especially, I think it was for black-capped chickadees. And a few days later, there was a nest in, and he had a little door made so that he could keep checking on the birds.
Jared actually handles wild baby robins and cares for them after they're old enough to leave the nests, and it doesn't seem to bother their mothers.
He's afraid that these robins will get eaten by the cats during the night. So we have this portable dog kennel, and he puts the babies in the kennel for the evening or for the night. And the mother actually will come to the dog kennel and bring the worms. So she feeds them, Jared feeds them, and the neighborhood kids all come and feed the baby robins.
Well, my uncle, who lives up Grandy, he used to have, I think, 5 chickens, and I was really interested in those, and he brought me up there. And I always used to go up there and look at his chickens. And then I just wanted to get chickens, so I kept begging my dad. And finally we went down to Little Burnt Bay and got some.
His father, Phil, says he noticed Jared's serious love for birds some time ago.
I noticed that he spent all his time in the spring collecting or looking at birds and studying robins and sparrows. And we bought him a pair of binoculars and a bird-watching book, and he'd spend all day up in the woods checking out birds, and he knew where every nest was in the neighborhood.
His clothes good enough.
Jared loves his chickens, but he says there's a bit more to it than just feeding and collecting the eggs.
Scrape all that stuff out, make sure the light bulb's hot enough for the water so it doesn't freeze, because they always need water, and just make sure it's always clean stuff, clean their bedding out, and make sure their feed's always nice and fresh.
Who was sitting on this one? Who was sitting on that
Rose.
One?
Rose. Rose was.
Then Jared got an incubator and managed to hatch his own chicken.
I think we were the only people that had a little chicken running around the living room and, you know, thinking that Jared was his mother. So
he's still a little sad. The chick only lived for 3 weeks. But Jared's not giving up. Now he's learned about a hatchery in Whitburn, and he's trying to get his parents to let him get even more chickens.
He's talking about these hens and, you know, the next breed he's going to get, and he located a hatchery somewhere in around St. John's, and he wanted me to call the hatchery to find out when the chicks are going to be ready, and so he's fascinated. You know, he's persistent. He doesn't let up. If he got something in his mind, he will not let go.
Yeah, it's a Barrett Rock. It's going extinct, and I want one of those. So it's white with black speckles. They're good layers.
You're too big to take down, aren't you?
Sure.
And, of course, it doesn't hurt that there's fresh eggs every morning, and Jared likes eggs.
We just bring them home, wash them, and then put them in the fridge. And wait until the morning, and I'll have them for breakfast.
For now, it's a hobby, but his mother says it could lead anywhere.
Yeah, but, you know, he's up for it. He loves it, so, I mean, I like it because it's his interest, and that's who he is. So I'm just letting him go with it. Who knows? He might own a hatchery here someday. So...
In Gander, I'm David Zelser.
And that's it for this week's podcast. You can get in touch with us at cbc.ca by clicking Contact Us. Throughout the week, you can keep up with stories from around Newfoundland and Labrador at cbc.ca/NL. I'm John Soper. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.